Case number
09-1535, I've asked to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. At issue in this case is whether it was clearly established in 2002 that someone who's lawfully arrested but refuses to identify himself under all the exceptional circumstances that were in play regarding these plaintiffs, whether they had a Fourth Amendment right not to be subjected to a brief search requiring them to drop their pants upon entering the cell block. This when the Supreme Court had itself already ruled that such searches were in fact lawful under the Fourth Amendment in Bell v. Wolfish.
Does it contain any detail about what is called the cell block? Plaintiffs rest very heavily on the notion that it's radically different in some way from the facility into which the prisoner in Bell versus Wolfish, or prisoners, I guess it was the practice that was challenged, were being placed, which they were being put. But it isn't crystal clear to me that it's different in any way, or
well,
the differences might be.
There is some detail in the depositions of the plaintiffs and Mr. Dillard. There is one significant level of detail that's in our statement of material facts was that once the plaintiffs came in, although they may have been maintained together, they would be moved through the corridors through cells that contained other prisoners. So that much is.
Can I say that sentence again?
Certainly. One of the statements of material fact, I can't remember if it was 28 or 38, but it indicated that these prisoners, even though they were maintained relatively together, that they would be moved through the corridors of the Superior Court cell block through cells that had other prisoners in them. So the plaintiffs at one point...
That's confusing.
Certainly.
They're through corridors and they get taken through cells that have other prisoners?
Or by cells that have other prisoners.
Remember,
the cells, and our concern there is that these are not cells that are walled off by concrete walls. These are cells that people can throw things through, people can reach through, people can kick things from the floor, drop something and kick it through into the cells.
So, when they get taken, when they reach the end point, the point to which they're being taken, what is that? That's a single large room that will hold them all, or what?
I don't think that's correct. There are various cells, and the testimony here was actually that these arrestees, having been arrested on a day of mass protest, went through a slightly different procedure than is typical. They first went to Blue Plains training facility for MPD, then to the Superior Court cell block B. I haven't seen it myself, but that's separate from, as I understand it, the one in the Superior Court courthouse itself. And then they enter that cell block downstairs where they become in marshal's custody. And that's where, when they first arrive in that courthouse, that's when the searches would have taken place.
Is the record clear where a defendant arrested for burglary or armed robbery or a drug offense would have been taken?
I hate to say this because the difficulty I'm having in answering your question, Your Honor, is that there are two cases going on similarly at the same time. More detail has come about in the discovery in the other case, the Johnson case. than in the Boehm case. And so if I answer the question, I might have the facts right, but the case wrong. In other words, it could be that that
revealed. Stick to the record in this case.
My understanding is what the record in this case shows is that we haven't distinguished between what the prisoners in the cells that the plaintiffs would have been allowed to parade past or go past or be next to, what those people were charged with. That's in Boehm. I think that there's more detail in the other case.
What is the distinction in terms of the Superior Court between passing by cells in a corridor and prisoners who are in the general population?
Well, keep in mind that courts have said that intermingling of prisoners may be one basis that one could rely upon to conclude that it's reasonable to conduct a search, as they did in Bell v. Wolfish. And the intermingling isn't necessarily limited to once they get into the Superior Court courtroom itself.
So is that the record doesn't tell me the answer to my question?
Well, the record does show that the plaintiffs were intermingled with a large group of people at Blue Plains that still had possession of all their personal property, that they were again intermingled, and people would come and go from the cell in cell block B. Then they would come into the Superior Court cell block in the Superior Court's courthouse itself, and from that point they would immediately be searched. But that after that, you could expect that they would be, and it depends on how you want to define intermingled. They may not be locked in the same cell, these particular people, as a murderer, but they were.
Look at it as the courts have looked at it.
Well.
Distinguishing between persons who are to be housed in the general population as distinct from people who are otherwise in custody of law enforcement officials.
Right. Well, and keep in mind that the difficulty we have is courts have not been uniform in what that means to be in a general population or intermingled or to have
Somehow, as a trial prosecutor, you're familiar with the distinction, I trust.
Well, I have to say what the Supreme Court said in Bell was that the test of reasonableness isn't capable of precise definition or mechanical application. That, to me, says that you have to look at the individual factual scenario at issue in your particular matter. And what we know is that the Superior Court had a lot of problems with contraband by people who were in there for misdemeanors and people who were in there for more serious offenses. And that they were maintained together, and that the marshal had a significant concern for the safety of the inmates and the safety of the judges that the prisoners would go to.
Found that the marshal had an absolute policy: anyone coming in the cell block is strip searched.
And I would
is you don't argue that's clearly erroneous, do you?
I think it was erroneous for the court to assess the subjective intent of the marshal, yes.
No, that wasn't my question.
But if the court, I think there was a factual basis for the court to conclude that consistent with the Marshal Service policy and consistent with Bell v. Wolfish, that the prisoners that came through the cell block, a cell block that had a long history of contraband, were to be required to have the drop and squat procedure performed on them. Now, in fact, the testimony presented by one of the marshals that was there that day was that these people were not actually searched. But I think the judge recognized that there was a factual dispute about that. Our request for purposes of resolving the qualified immunity issue was to assume that the plaintiffs got searched the way they claim they did, even though we have contrary evidence. It would not have been clearly established in 2002 that was inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment or inconsistent with Bell v. Wolfish. And I think the Devenpeck case is where the court struck home that the objective standard is really necessary, not with the subjective intent of whoever the decision maker was, but what a reasonable law enforcement officer would have believed was constitutional, or more importantly, whether it was clearly established that those plaintiffs had some constitutional right not to be searched, where they're refusing to identify themselves. That has been determined by at least two courts prior to 2002 to be a basis for...
Relying on that is an argument that there is no indication that the defendant Dillard specifically relied on that.
That's correct. That's the same thing that the Supreme Court looked at in Devenpeck. They said, no, you can't look at what the officer was intending subjectively to arrest a person for. You have to look and see what an objective officer could have arrested the person for in a reasonable manner. And that's what applies. And I think that's why the district court got it wrong when she concluded that there was a red herring. That's because she was applying a subjective standard, and the Supreme Court had said, no, you have to do an objective standard.
Just to be clear about one thing, perhaps I misunderstood, but I take your argument to be initially, before you get into the problem of whether there was an objective standard used, before you get to whether this case is distinctive because of the refusal to give names and so on, that there simply wasn't a clear rule in 2002.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. That's our position. There was not. And I understand we've gone back and forth about whether, with the district court and with plaintiff's counsel, about whether Powell can really be applied here because it came after the fact. But to the extent that it's just analyzing what the law was back when Bell was decided, it's a very good history of why it is that Bell would allow this, or certainly why Bell can reasonably be interpreted to allow this.
I
see that I'm into my time. If I may reserve my 5 minutes, I would like to do so. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Lynn Cunningham, attorney for Paul Boehm and the other named plaintiffs, whom I refer to as protester plaintiffs, generally speaking. I believe that I contend that the lower court properly followed the unanimous, long-established national case law as it applies to plaintiff protesters being strip-searched in rejecting Dillard's qualified immunity defense.
Well, let's start with that because that's also where Mr. Nebaker just finished.
Thank you.
What about the point that Powell, which comes afterwards, is interpreting a Supreme Court case which precedes the events here and which is arguably inconsistent with the subsequent appellate decisions?
Well, both Powell and Bull in the Ninth Circuit en banc re-examined Bell, but both Powell and Bell found that persons in the category or status of the plaintiff protesters could not be strip searched. And yeah, Bull was very
clear. I don't see that in Powell.
I thought Powell was a pretty broadly written authorization.
It is broadly written, but it remands for further examination the issue of how should they treat people who are not going to be transferred into a detention facility.
Where were the people in Powell?
I'm sorry, I don't have the opinion before me, but that is my reading of the opinion, that they did not simply lump the persons who are not going into the detention facility, but they instead remanded that issue for further consideration.
Well, it seems to me the key sentence is the first sentence of the last paragraph in Section 2. In conclusion, assuming the arrestees being booked, that arrestees being booked into a jail or detention facility retain some Fourth Amendment right, those rights are not violated by policy or practice of strip searching, etc. So the category being covered is arrestees being booked into a jail or detention facilities. And
that's correct, and it does not refer...
Why isn't cell block B a detention facility?
They were not strip searched in cell block B. It's not under the supervision of the marshal. They're strip searched in a superior court lockup, which is an entirely separate facility from cell block B.
Correction. Why is a superior court lockup not a jail or detention facility?
because it is not an overnight facility. It's not a facility where...
Where do you find in the constitutional decisions an overnight versus not overnight distinction?
Well, primarily in Bull and in Powell, as I say, and in all the other decisions since...
I've just been looking at Powell, and I don't see an overnight distinction there at all.
Well, I read the term detention facility to mean a long-term overnight facility.
Yeah,
these are
the
folks who are passing...
Detention,
excuse me.
I read detention as being something, just the opposite, as being short-term as opposed to prison.
Well, I didn't handle that appeal, Your Honor. I don't believe a detention facility was the same as a lockup where the...
Given the interests that are set forth in favor of allowing officers to do this, why should overnight, just as a matter of reasoning, why should overnight versus not overnight make any difference?
Because this group of prisoners were not being commingled with other folks who had been arrested on the street. These are peaceful protesters who had been kept together as one body of prisoners during the entire sequence of events.
I don't see the cases as drawing a distinction between a set of misdemeanor defendants and a being joined to a set of others. It does seem to be a stress on there being more than one, but I don't see anything in the decisions which makes the others that are in the group being booked not count. Why don't they count?
Well, the Bell versus Wolfish was based on the court giving deference to the administrator of the Metropolitan Correction Facility in New York City, at Metropolitan Correction Center. And the prison administrator in that situation had decided that contact visits were sufficiently liable to give rise to smuggling that of contraband.
Speaks much that, more broadly than just contact.
But that's... Excuse me, go ahead.
I finished. It's true that contact visits are the precipitating event, but the opinion is much more broadly worded, and well-advised courts of appeals usually pay attention to.
Yes, sir. The court in Bell versus Wolfish urged a balancing of factors, and one of the factors in that case was that the administrator of the prison had said contact visits are sufficiently of a concern that strip searches should be carried out. However, the administrator of the lockup in this case determined, that is, the defendant Dillard, said, I'm not going to do strip searches. He ceased doing them in March of 2003, a few months after this. So the key factor in Bell was the court's paying deference to the administrator. Here the administrator has determined that he's not going to do strip searches of everyone any longer. That's point one. Point two is...
I mean, that sounds like the sort of problem that existed before Chevron, that of an agency changing its mind. I mean, the fact that there's an era of a no-strip search policy followed by what may be simply an episode of a strip search policy doesn't seem to me to change anything.
Well, I believe that the...
I mean, on your factual claims, Dillard made the opposite determination here, that there should be a strip search.
He had continued a policy that was in existence when he took office about 8 or 10 years before. A second point is that Deputy Foley testified that there was no grounds to strip search these persons. And so the concern in Powell that strip searches may be needed for long-term detention facilities or overnight detention facilities simply was not present in this situation. There are other distinctions between the lockup and a detention facility such as the D.C. jail. There's no meals served. There's no housing of them. There's no...
Was there anything to give clear guidance on that distinction in 2002?
Well, yes, the clear guidance, I would say, comes from the 10 out of 12 circuits that had ruled on this case, on this issue, and had said strip searching persons of this category violated the Fourth Amendment. So there was a huge amount of guidance, as well as the Halton case and the the Morgan versus Berry.
So there were a bunch of cases, or maybe all of the cases as of 2002, pardon me, concerned short-term detentions, not overnight detentions?
Well, the majority of them did, but some of them indeed, like Giles versus Ackerman within the Ninth Circuit, said even putting someone into a longer, as I'm calling it, the long-term detention facility, you could not strip search persons who were in the category of my plaintiffs.
That category being?
Being nonviolent, non-drug-related, non-misdemeanor or less.
And that falls under the shadow later cast by Powell.
That's right, although, again, I contend that Powell affirms what Judge Collier is saying in her opinion, or backs it up. And Judge Collier was not sort of stepping out somewhere on her own. And
did she talk about Powell? I don't remember.
Yes, she did. I believe she
did. Counsel, I just want to report that my clerk has checked Powell. Where it's overnight, sleep, night, and food, none of those four words appears in it.
In I'm sorry, what?
In Powell.
Well, that may be true, but if they were we go back to, I can supply the court with a fuller description of the record in Powell, and they did remand for further determination on this matter. So,
what about the government's argument that the district court erred by not applying an objective standard?
I would contend that the objective standard was that there was a clear record of cases with the 10 circuits that had ruled already, as well as all the U.S. District Court cases that have ruled in favor of not permitting strip searching of this category of persons. The court was also aware of the court could not find any case where other courts would permit strip searching of persons in this category. That creates the law context for a objective determination, and so the what Mr. Dillard in his brief is terming subjective issues fall away in light of the consensus of cases, and the particular factors such as the failure so-called failure to identify, and the some of the websites on touting shutting down the city, they fall away upon closer examination because Mr. Dillard didn't consider whether someone identified themselves or not. That was not a part of a subjective or objective consideration. His policy was to strip search everyone, and as Mr. Dillard states at his brief, Mr. Dillard paid no attention to whether someone had identified themselves. Their identity was not of concern. If it had been, he might have used the live scan machines available in the jail, in the lockup, to identify folks and check their backgrounds. He didn't do that because he wasn't concerned about it.
The district court does deal with Powell, but I'm not sure yet exactly how. Footnote. Her page 13, app 441, where the text says, as nearly every court has found, a footnote says, the only decision otherwise is the aforementioned Powell versus Barrett in 08. That case, unlike this one, involved strip searches of pretrial arrestees who were to be commingled with the general inmate population charged with various serious offenses. No other court, as far as this court can tell, has found it reasonable to perform strip searches on nonviolent, non-felony arrestees without any justification. Now, that by itself doesn't deal with the question of whether Powell suggests or Powell's existence means there was ambiguity in 2002.
That's
but
correct.
Perhaps when she says she deals with it later, she addresses that question. I'm just yet to find out where that would be. And if you or Mr. Nebaker can point me in the right direction, I would appreciate it.
I believe.
Here's a reference. Defendant Dillard argues that the 2008 case of Powell is his ace in the hole.
Yes, that's it.
Okay. Then she states Powell revisiting the Supreme Court's Bell decision, the 11th Circuit reasoned, et cetera, et cetera. Dillard argues Powell muddies the waters as to the law and arrested pre-arraignment strip searches, so he's entitled to qualified immunity. Not so. Even if it were possible for a decision coming 6 years after the incidents in question to affect the analysis, this court's inquiry must focus on the specific facts and circumstances at hand, not on facts that other courts have faced. And the underlying facts are crucially distinct from Powell. So this is how she's dealing with it. It's that unlike those arrested in Powell, plaintiffs were detained together at all times and never commingled with the general inmate population.
That's correct. They have never. They were never commingled. And again, I think
Could you just tell me more briefly, just remind me what you said about why that matters?
Well, the inmates are not housed overnight. That is, they're not given sleeping facilities. There are no facilities for feeding the inmates. There's not
She just says they're not commingled. She didn't start going to get
that. That's probably the crucial one.
That's what she says. It's crucially distinct.
Yes.
Because they're not commingled.
Well, I obviously...
They're commingled with each other.
Yeah. These people have refused to give their names.
Like everyone else who came through the court.
Yeah. Suppose,
through the lockup.
So suppose you're one of the nonviolent protesters and you have every intention to remain peaceful and so on.
Absolutely.
And you are arrested along with a bunch of people whose intentions were quite different and who refused to give their names, and you're all put in the same cell, not commingled with the people who are there on suspicion of rape and murder. And these people are not strip searched and they have contraband with them. Aren't you a little concerned about being locked up with them?
Well, I'm not being locked up with them. I'm being held very shortly while I wait for arraignment in court.
Right. So if they have a razor blade in their undergarments until that arraignment occurs, you're at risk.
Well, I don't think so. All of us have gone through a metal detector. So any kind of metal weapons would have been discovered. There were thorough pat-downs. And so I would not be concerned. Also, these are peaceful protesters. I mean, that's what says. That's what they understand. And the people in that group, let me just finish if I may, are no different than the general public out on the street.
Well, they don't know who they are. I mean, there are a bunch of people, some of whom may have been here with the intent to, quote, shut down the city, and others of whom are here for the summer of love.
They could be. But the website on shutting down the city, if you look at it more carefully in the record, simply says there's some phrase, shut down the city, but most of it is, let's get together and protest and express our rights. There are no violent plans to conduct violent activities. So that's quite different.
So the worst that could happen is you're locked up with people who insist on singing Guantanamera the whole time.
And I understand they did sing, but it's no different than being out on the street. You don't know who's standing next to you on the subway. And the Constitution doesn't permit strip searching everybody in a situation simply because they might be carrying a weapon. That's what the Fourth Amendment is about. It draws a bright line about reasonable suspicion before someone can be strip searched. I see I am out of time.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you so much for it.
I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that when we're analyzing this qualified immunity issue, we're looking at the rights of the particular plaintiffs involved and whether a reasonable law enforcement officer would have known that they had a right not to be strip searched or drop, squatted, and coughed. It's actually a modified strip search under DOJ regs. And the fact of the matter is there was no clear rule after Bell. Although plaintiff's counsel likes to say there were 10 out of 12 circuits that have addressed it, they haven't addressed the issues that were actually in play here. And Bell v. Wolfish said it's a precise, it is not capable of precise definition or mechanical application. Here you had people, you didn't know who you had. You could have had Osama bin Laden. You don't know. They refused to identify themselves. They're all together. They were with a group of people, some of whom have now left, but were locked up with them and commingled with them out beforehand with their backpacks. They are arrested on a day when the intelligence reports are, there's escalating violence in these IMF demonstrations, and they're attempting to shut down the city. Plaintiffs admitted that.
Is it relevant at all that these people had been held together when they were at Blue Plains and at cell block B? And there was no complaint of any injury by anyone in this isolated group, no razor blades, no guns, no knives.
Well, there had also been
and so the marshal, the question is whether, as I understand it, he had to take those facts into consideration in determining whether or not a strip search was necessary.
And the answer is you don't crawl into the head of the marshal to assess those things.
Well, they you are look at the objective facts of the court knowledge the marshal had. And I'm saying one objective fact is these people had been isolated together all this time and allowed to keep their backpacks and whatever else they had. And no one has complained of any injury or any untoward singing or anything like that. And they come for arraignment, and they're put through the same process as the rapist, the murderer, the drug
and
defendant. And that's the question, isn't it?
I think what you'll find is that almost every incident report where they recover drugs, I know one of, as one exception, people were behaving, if you will, up until the point where the item of contraband was recovered.
No, but is there any evidence that there was any contraband on these people?
Well, there's evidence. Again, you have to keep in mind that you have to look at it in the based upon the facts at the time that the searches were conducted.
I know, so that's why I'm looking at the objective facts. And one of the things your brief emphasizes is all the prior discoveries of contraband upon a strip search at the Superior Court.
Correct. And what I was going to point out was that in Bell, the court looked at the same kind of assessment. Oh, we're not picking particular people because they've been with somebody that's a drug mule or something. We're just doing a category of people who've had contact visits. So obviously the Supreme Court views it as something you can do on a categorical basis. And if people have been housed together with, you don't know who they are, you know they've been housed together with a bunch of other hippie types, which is a group that's known to use drugs, and they've had their backpacks with them the whole time, they could have the opportunity in that period of time to hide things on them. Also, these were people who knew they were going to get arrested.
The Supreme Court drew the distinction between people who are going to be in the general population.
I don't think that it has. Certainly not clearly established that it has.
How would it clearly establish it other than referencing that fact as a seminal fact in the opinion?
Well, the opinion talks about how these are people. It doesn't talk about whether they have felony backgrounds, misdemeanor backgrounds. The Supreme Court pointed out that these could be just witnesses, you know, that are being housed, and that they go have a contact visit, and they come back, and they get the drop, squat, and cough procedure, and that's constitutional.
I understood it. The argument was they failed to provide any identification. These prior discoveries, and that in the past, IMF protests had resulted in violence. And that's the objective knowledge.
Well, I think there were a host of other items that may not have been emphasized as well as I could have, but I think there were a lot of things that were taking place with these people.
So when peaceful protesters come to the nation's capital to protest, they should all expect to be strip searched.
Well, we knew from Foti and from Wachtler that if you refuse to identify yourselves, that can be a basis for doing a drop, squat, and cough search.
But according to the marshal's policy, that was irrelevant.
Well, not for these plaintiffs. Keep in mind, the analysis for the court to apply
is... the marshal's policy, this marshal's policy,
this marshal
took that into account.
This marshal's policy, which it was consistent with the central office policy, took into consideration the agency from which you are taking custody of the prisoners, and where they're being housed. And given that there was such a high level of contraband recovered in the Superior Court, I think that in and of itself, it's, at least it's not clearly established that that wasn't enough to do a drop, squat, and cuff. But here you have to look at all the circumstances, just like the court said in Devenpeck, not just the ones that the officer thought about at the time, but all of them. And they include all those other things, that they refused to identify themselves, they want to shut down the city, there was escalated violence, Molotov cocktails the year before at one of these things.
So all these people who come to protest on January 28th every year have to fear strip searches.
If they get arrested and refuse to identify themselves, keep in mind, a lot of the people identified themselves and were released on I think it was citation release or posting a small bond. So we've already removed from the equation a lot of the people who got arrested for demonstrating and were willing to identify themselves. It was only the people that refused to identify themselves that even ended up in the Superior Court cell. And we didn't know who they were. They could have been murderers. They refused to identify themselves, so we couldn't check their criminal history.
They could have been murderers.
Well, and what I'm saying,
I don't want to make that argument.
Well, what I'm saying is by refusing to identify, some courts have said you can consider the criminal history of an individual. And it's not clearly established that you can't consider the fact that the person is trying to hide their criminal history from you by refusing to identify themselves for you. Except we know that in Foti and Wachtler, it was enough.
It doesn't add anything to the fact that they refused to identify themselves, right? That's all you got there.
Well,
you don't know who they are because they refuse to identify themselves.
That's correct. Period. And the one point is
plaintiffs. Does that mean that everybody in this class was among the ones who refused to identify themselves?
That's correct.
I thought you had a lockup sheet with some John Doe's and some names.
The plaintiffs admitted in discovery responses that's one of the things that we learned in discovery is that they weren't contesting that every one of the plaintiffs in the class was a John Doe. They refused to identify themselves.
I thought only the named plaintiffs acknowledged that.
No, we got them to admit that each of the plaintiffs in the purported class had failed to identify themselves. Everyone else got released. We know who you are. Fine, show up here on a citation or pay a bond.
Historically, in this community, when people come here to protest, the protesters are kept separate from the general population, and they are brought to the courthouse for purposes of arraignment. And it's been done for years and years without treating them like they're part of the general population of criminals, violent criminals.
Well, one of the things you have to remember, again, is that the Supreme Court in Bell said that was okay to do that to even witnesses. Forget what their criminal history was. If they were a witness and they were coming into this area where there's concern for the safety and security of the institution, the judges you can add to this one, and the marshals and the prisoners, that it was okay to do the drop, squat, and cuff procedure even on just them. And it didn't talk about whether it was overnight or not overnight. The fact of the matter is the marshal owes an obligation to the prisoners not to subject them to injury, known injury from fellow prisoners. And so if he's got an obligation to safeguard them, he has an obligation to ensure that they don't have weapons in the facility. And also drugs can be a security concern. The metal...
drugs a danger to others?
Yeah, it turns out what we've learned is that they're going to cause fights. If so-and-so is in withdrawal and so-and-so, the other guy next to him has drugs, they're going to end up in a fight over those drugs. At least that's a legitimate security concern. Plaintiff's counsel pointed out, Appellee's counsel pointed out that metal weapons could be discovered through a magnetometer. That's actually proved incorrect, that there are metal weapons that are small enough that they didn't work.
I mean, we're just blurring distinctions between people who there has been no suspicion whatsoever, all right, much less probable cause that they've committed an offense.
And all I can tell you, Judge, is that the Supreme Court looked at it. They had pause, too, and they said it was okay given the need for security in the institution. And that's all Marshall Dillard was trying to ensure, was the security of the institution. Okay. There's just no clear rule after Bell, and none of those cases that plaintiffs have relied on are really on point with the facts we had here. We would, therefore, ask that this court reverse the action of the district court and direct judgment in favor of Mr. Dillard based on Mr. Dillard's qualified
immunity. I'm looking at 223 here on the question of whether everyone in the class refused to give a name. response to interrogatory number two is all named plaintiffs refused to identify themselves. There are class members who provided their names prior to being strip searched, and their names are included in the lockup list.
Can I draw the court's attention to appendix page 337?
337?
Correct. This is our statement of material facts, number three, which did not get any objection from the plaintiffs. It says, at the time of the events alleged in the second amended complaint, it goes on to list the named plaintiffs, and the remaining class members had been arrested by MPD, but had refused to provide their true names to law enforcement authorities, instead remaining identified to authorities only as John Doe's. They didn't object to that at all.
I'd like to get Mr. Cunningham's reaction to that, if you don't mind. Mr. Cunningham, what's the state of the record on this issue?
Yes, Your Honor, it's my understanding that all of the persons in this class did not identify themselves. However, Diller did not pay attention to the names of the people he was strip searching. It was not of concern to him. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cunningham. Mr. Nebaker, if there's nothing further.
What we'd like to emphasize, Your Honor, is that the qualified immunity analysis requires you to focus on the rights of the particular plaintiffs involved. And here, given the myriad of problems and concerns that a reasonable law enforcement officer could have, that it was not clearly established that Bell didn't permit these searches.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nevick and Mr. Cunningham. Thank you both. Case is submitted.